I want to pick up on a series that was begun quite some time ago. Somewhat kiddingly, I call it Visigoth's Bedtime Stories. That's something we did from time to time. But this is a continuation of the one that opened up the book Ominous Parallels, The End of Freedom in America. And that was written by Leonard Peikoff. And that came out in about 1982. I'm refreshing myself. Yeah, it was published in 1982. I put up the first link of the audio. This is the second installment. And I bring it up because it has to start to get somewhat resonant in your minds that we have become our enemy. Somehow, and I won't get into it now, but whenever America goes on the offensive, it's okay. You know, if Russia were to invade Canada, we'd be all pissed off. But it's okay for us to go in and everywhere out there in the Middle East. And that statement, that non sequitur, the rallying cry after 2001 is that we're safer here for fighting over there. Completely nonsensical. Right from the Mad Hatter's Tea Party. All right? The thing is, you don't get safer going someplace else if the problem happened because certain individuals penetrated your borders. All right? So that alone. You see, that's the history of the United States. We're always threatened by whatever happens 3,000 miles away. But the thing is, after World War II, we have become our enemy. And there is a nasty, malignant strain that is developing in the United States that we would equate with that which took place in Nazi Germany. Now, I'm going to go to chapter 2 that was entitled The Totalitarian Universe, and I'm not going to go through the whole thing, because for the most part, really, here, I don't excise anything from what I read that I feel is at odds with the way I believe. I do it mainly because I just want to not, I'm not going to read the whole book, and I want you to. Now, Peikoff, you know, is got his flaws and all that other stuff. And what people tell me now, you know, he's on a libertarian bandwagon. He doesn't get it because the era of government is over for all of us. Okay? Government sucks. And you can't vote in good government. Because whoever you vote for is a sold-out cocksucker, too. That's the way I'm going to tell you straight out. They are knee-pad-wearing whores. And I hate them. And you should hate them too, and you should understand you have no government. So let's take a look at what happens here and what's going on in this country. As things get worse here, we're going to look for someone to blame it on. We need a boogeyman. Maybe it'll be Iran, most likely. And then it'll become China and Russia. And we're going to get into a fight that we cannot win. And that's also destined. So pardon my French, but we have been given up by really rotten, and I wouldn't even use the word human beings, more like subnoid beings. All right. Now, in this chapter 2, Peikoff goes along. And understand, he's an Ayn Rand devotee, and he thinks religion is the opiate of the masses, and organized religion is. But, I mean, you know, the guy's an atheist, so, you know, good luck with that. But he talks about the nation of Germany, and by extension, this country, which seems to cleave to the philosophy of Plato and Kant and Hegel. And the antidote to these three, he states, would be Aristotle. I'm not going to get into the whole thing about this because it isn't like that anybody who likes Plato, Kant, or Hegel is a bad person. It's just that their philosophies and what they were pushing for finds a certain a resonance with certain people, and that isn't good. Now, I don't particularly care. Plato, to me, was an absolute elitist. You know, Hegel knew how to manipulate the masses. I don't really care about all that. I care about the fact that what is a certain population embracing as acceptable? I know that's kind of I know that's kind of vague, but anybody who wants to do any kind of research themselves on the three of them, they can. In fact, Hegel is the one who gave us the Hegelian dialectic, so he knew how things worked. You can't fault him for that. But and Plato especially is an elitist and someone who we somewhat, I guess, feel warm and fuzzy about because he was, I don't know, a Greek philosopher. But the guy was, you know, he wanted children taken away from their home so they could bring being brought out into the countryside to be taught by the philosopher kings. Or, in other words, today's day and age, it takes a village to raise a child or all that any kind of crap. But anyway, that's what it is. Plato, yeah, I don't consider him any friend of the masses. So I'll just skim what he says about these philosophers. About Plato, he says, the father of collectivism in the West. He is the first thinker to formulate a systematic view of reality with a collectivist politics as its culmination. All right, fine. He was a collectivist. You know, your only worth is, as an individual, is to what you can contribute to the republic. And I don't care about titles. Well, we want a republic. Okay, fine. Well, we're a democracy. No, we're not a democracy. We're a constitutional republic. It's all garbage. It's all non sequiturs. It's all babble. Okay? You can call anything that you want. I've been through this with some of the folks that I email with. Call it socialism. Call it whatever you want to call it. The thing is, it never really existed as it was written up. It was just something that was named. And, you know, as somebody else, because I want to cite the people that contribute ideas and good information to what I'm fortunate to be part of, and that is a decent discussion group who doesn't seem to be jaded by some stupid belief in partisan politics or, you know, that there's some kind of white hat riders that are going to come down and save us all just before, like, oh, the Indians get us. So our next stop is Kant. All right, and we'll back up a little bit where it ends, and it says this section on Plato. It said, the tragedy of the West, however, lies in the fact that the seeds of Platonism have been firmly embedded in philosophy almost from its beginning and have been growing steadily through the post-Renaissance period. Thus, while the revolutionary achievements inspired by Aristotelianism were reshaping the life of the West, an intellectual counter-revolution was at work, gradually gathering momentum. A succession of thinkers was striving to reverse the Aristotelian trend and to resurrect the basic principles of Platonism. And it said, the climax of this development came in the late 18th century. The man who consummated the successful anti-Aristotelian revolution, the man who more than any other put an end to the Enlightenment and opened the door to its opposite, was a German philosopher, the most influential German philosopher in history, Immanuel Kant. One of Kant's major goals was to save religion from the onslaughts of science. His system represents a massive effort to raise the principles of Platonism in a somewhat altered form, once again to a position of commanding authority over Western culture. Kant places his primary emphasis on epistemological issues. His method of attack is to wage a campaign against the human mind. Man's mind, he holds, is unable to acquire any knowledge of reality. And I'm not going to get any deeper into that. You know, I'm going to hit this really lightly because to me sometimes this just gets to be so much bullcrap. When it talks about Hegel, it says, the most famous of these men, the most influential, the ruling figure of 19th century philosophy was Hegel. Hegel is a post-Kantian Platonist, who cares, taking full advantage of the anti-Aristotelianism sanctioned by Kant. Hegel launches an attack on the root principles of Aristotle's philosophy, on the principles of Aristotelian logic, which even Kant had not dared to challenge directly. Reality, declares Hegel, is inherently contradictory. It is a systematic progression of colliding contradictions organized in triads of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. And there is your Hegelian dialectic. And men must think accordingly. They should not strive for old-fashioned static consistency. They should not be limited by the one-sided Aristotelian view that every existent has a specific identity, that things are what they are, that A is A. On the contrary, they owe their ultimate allegiance to a higher principle, the principle of the identity of opposites, the principle that things are not what they are, that A is non-A. Hegel describes the above as a new conception of reason, and as a new dialectic logic. And I think we can agree that it is true, and what's very evident with Hegel's dialectic is that it is, when you're in power, the best thing to do is keep everybody at odds. So if you can create a problem and you can gauge the response and then provide the solution, you're in pretty good shape, all the while looking like there is actually some kind of organic battle going on. It's the same in the United States. And I've said, you know, our government acts much like an abusive parent. I mean, they'll slap the crap out of you, and then it will come back and nurture you and bring you back again. And everybody's kind of like, well, okay, you know, you're supposed to be good, but I'm not really getting this, but it's the only thing I know, so I'll deal with it. So anyway, we'll talk about Hegel. The ethics in politics, which Hegel derives from his fundamental philosophy, can be indicated by two sentences from his philosophy of right. Quote, a single person, I need hardly say, is something subordinate, and as such he must dedicate himself to the ethical whole. Hence, if the state claims life, the individual must surrender it. End of quote. Hegel's collectivism and state worship are more explicit than anything to be found in Plato's writings. Since everything is ultimately one, the group he holds has primacy over the individual. If each man learns to suppress his identity and coalesce with his fellows, the resulting collective entity, the state, will be a truer reflection of reality, a higher manifestation of the absolute. The state, in this view, is not an association of autonomous individuals. It is itself an individual, a mystic person, that swallows up the citizens and transcends them, an independent, self-sustaining organism made of human beings with a will and purpose of its own. A quote, all the worth which the human being possesses, writes Hegel, all spiritual reality he possesses only through the state. The state organism is no mere secular entity. As a manifestation of the absolute, it is a creature of God, and thus demands not merely obedience from its citizens, but reverential worship. A quote, the state is the divine idea as it exists on earth. The march of God in the world, that is what the state is. All right, that's the end of the quote. The purpose of the state, therefore, is not the protection of its citizens. The state is not a means to any human end. As an entity with supernatural credentials, it is an absolute, unmoved end in itself, and it has supreme right against the individual whose supreme duty is to be a member of the state. The above are the kinds of political ideas which Hegel, more than any other man, injected into the mind of early 19th century Germany. Perpetuated in a variety of forms by a long chain of secondary figures and derivative influences, these ideas gradually became commonplaces in Germany and in other countries, including Italy. The aspiring dictators of the 20th century and their intellectual defenders moved with alacrity to embrace such commonplaces and to cash in on them. Both the fascists and the Nazis were in the forefront of this trend. In the fascist literature, the influence of Hegel is generally acknowledged. Prominent neo-Hegelian philosophers such as Mario Palmieri and Giovanni Gentile uphold fascism on a Hegelian foundation and earned a formal endorsement from Mussolini. The world seen through fascism, writes Mussolini, is, and here we go, not this material world which appears on the surface, in which man is an individual separated from all others and standing by himself. The man of fascism is an individual who is nation and fatherland, which is a moral law, binding together individuals and the generations into a tradition and a mission, suppressing the instinct for a life enclosed within the brief round of pleasure in order to restore, within duty, a higher life free from the limits of time and space. End of the quote. The Nazi literature is not so overtly Hegelian in its formulations. Posing as a spokesman for a higher biological truth, the Nazis generally dropped the idealistic metaphysics of Hegel and even attacked him. Admittedly or not, however, the Nazis, like the fascists, rely on the ideas of Hegel, not only for their basic collectivist approach, but for many of the more specific political theories necessary to implement it in practice. Hegel, for instance, seeks to undercut any individualist opponents by proclaiming that statism represents a passion for human liberty. And I mean, I don't mean to do this, I won't interject, but did you check that out? Now, this to me is a complete oxymoron in a sense. That statism represents a passion for human liberty. And do you see what's happening in the United States? Because of 9/11/2001, we had our liberties severely curtailed. And it was it was told it was because it's all for our own good. And that this was necessary. I think even some of the people who most believe that this was the case might now take a look at what's gone on. And while this was happening, while we were told that we have to do surveillance and cut into individual rights and privacy to keep us safe, as we were losing, let's call it what it is, as we were basically losing freedoms, we were being barraged with more terms like Newark, Liberty Airport, and Freedom Fries, and all this crap. And you can tell, and I would hate to say this, but it's really a WAG's good line to say, when your government starts talking more and more about liberty and freedom, you can bet you're losing it. A man is free, Hegel explains, when he acts as he himself wills to act. But since, quote, the state is the true self of the individual, end of quote, what a man really wills, even though he may not know it, is what the state wills. Liberty, therefore, is obedience to the orders of the government. Such obedience guarantees true freedom for the real self, even if the illusory self is being sent to Auschwitz. The masses of men, notes Hegel, do not understand the above viewpoint. The people, therefore, quote, does not know what it wills. To know what one wills, and still more to know what the absolute will, reason wills, is the fruit of profound apprehension and insight, precisely the things which are not popular. This is why I hate philosophy. Did you hear anything that's more pretzel logic than this crap? I'm sorry, but you know what? That's the one subject in college. I mean, I thought I had a reasonable intellect, but you know what? People who major in philosophy, it's like, what is that? I mean, what is that? It's like majoring in make-believe. All right, here we go. Back to the text. Hence, Hegel, like Plato, is opposed to the theory of popularly elected representative government. Instead, he calls for an authoritarian state resembling a Prussian monarchy. The monarch's decrees, we are told, embody the true will of the people. Quote, and if liberty is to be the attribute of the real man, says Mussolini, and not of the scarecrow invented by the individualistic liberalism, then fascism is for liberty. It is for the only kind of liberty that is serious, the liberty of the state. Holy mackerel. Okay, end of the quote. And here's something from Otto Dietrich. There is no freedom of the individual. There is only freedom of peoples, nations, or races, for these are the only material and historical realities through which the life of the individual exists. Thank you for that, Otto Dietrich. And here's another one. From Huber, the Führerreich of the people is founded on the recognition that the true will of the people cannot be disclosed through parliamentary votes and plebiscites, but that the will of the people in its pure and uncorrupted form can only be expressed through the Führer. Can you believe this stuff? I mean, can you actually believe that they sold this crap? In his defense of monarchy, Hegel stops short of advocating complete dictatorship. In his theory of heroes, however, he makes little effort to conceal that this is his viewpoint. A few superior beings throughout the ages, he holds, ergo, Alexander, Caesar, Napoleon, have functioned as agents of the world spirit. What the hell is that? Oh, this is scary stuff. We move on. These men have been endowed with a special mission to advance the evolution of spirit, carry out the will of God in their era. Guided by Providence, the world historical hero seizes the initiative and takes direct action through him, the spirit, impinging on the outer world as on a shell bursted into pieces. Whatever that means. Such individuals, Hegel concedes, often leave a trail of corpses in their wake. Nevertheless, they are exempt from moral judgment. And here he says, for the history of the world occupies a higher ground than that on which morality has properly its position. Moral claims that are irrelevant must not be brought into collision with world historical deeds in their accomplishments. The litany of private virtues must not be raised against them. Unbelievable. Here, sanctioned by an intricate metaphysical system, is a call for militaristic dictator to throw aside morality and burst the world in pieces, in accordance with his concept of destiny. Issued by the most prestigious German philosopher of the 19th century, it is an invitation for a Führer to step forward. Philosophers cannot issue such invitations with impunity. One way or another, the next representative of the absolute is going to get the message. Quote from Hitler, in 37. However weak the individual may be when compared with the omnipotence and will of providence, yet at the moment when he acts as providence would have him act, he becomes immeasurably strong. Then there streams down upon him that force which has marked all greatness in the world's history. And when I look back only on the 5 years which lie behind us, then I feel that I am justified in saying that has not been the work of man alone. So these cats are calling down God on what they're doing. God's on our side. Wow. And it worked. And it's working here. Just as there are world historical heroes, according to Hegel, so there are world historical peoples. In any given era, he holds one nation is the special vehicle of the world spirit and its process of self-unfolding. That nation, he says, has absolute right over all others, which are without rights and count no longer in world history. Absolute right includes the right to launch war. War among nations, in Hegel's view, is an inevitable and desirable expression of the evolution of the spirit. And since the history of the world faithfully expresses this evolution, the nation that wins the wars of a given era is obviously the one backed by the spirit. Justice, therefore, must always be on the side of the winner. Might makes right. Stripped of its jargon, this is the meaning of Hegel's doctrine. Hegel's form of collectivism is nationalism. The nation he holds, not mankind as a whole, or the majority, or the race, or the proletariat, is the favored group, the one which is to be the standard of value and the collector of men's sacrifices. And of all the world's nations, he reports, Germany is the culmination to date. It is currently the representative of the spirit. Religions have often divided men into the chosen and the damned, and then interpreted history as the struggle of the chosen to carry out the divine plan. Hegel's philosophy of history amounts to this viewpoint. Hegel's distinctiveness, however, lies in his definition of the chosen. The messianic group on his theory is not the men of a particular religion or sect, but the men of a particular nationality. The initiators of German nationalism in the 19th century were not the military men, big business, or the middle classes. All these groups, notes Ludwig von Mises, were at first strongly opposed to the aspirations of pan-Germanism, but their resistance was vain because it lacked an ideological backing. There were no longer any liberal authors in Germany. Thus, the nationalist writers and professors easily conquered. Very soon, the youth came back from the universities and lower schools convinced pan-Germans. On this issue, the leading teacher of the teachers of the youth was Hegel. The Nazis accepted Hegel's theory with certain adaptations. The Nazis agree that a cosmic agency has divided men into two antithetic groups, the chosen and the damned, whose actions and destiny are predetermined and outside of any individual's choice or control. They agree that the chosen have absolute right to smash the rest of mankind. They agree that might, being the expression of destiny, makes right. But since they mix a certain element of biology into this framework, they often provide a different answer to the question, who chooses the chosen? It is not the world spirit that does it, Hitler often suggests, but nature, using the mechanism of the survival of the fittest. The chosen are catapulted to a position of world dominance, and their recourse to brutality is justified, not by the Hegelian process of evolution, but by the Darwinian. Although the catchphrases of the social Darwinists in the above form are all over Mein Kampf, they never attained the status of official party doctrine. Other Nazi writers remained free to denounce Darwin and Darwinism as incompatible with Nazism, as irreligious, mechanistic, internationalistic. On the whole, Nazism never decided this question. Nature and God, the Nazis sometimes say, are merely different forms in which the same reality manifests itself. So there is really no difference, after all, between natural and divine selection. Wow. The Nazis' predilection for biology plus religion culminates in their biological version of the chosen-damned dichotomy. The people chosen by God, nature, they hold, are not confined to a single nation. They are spread across the globe, marked off by a distinctive physical appearance. They are tall, long-headed, blonde, etc. And a special innate race soul, which makes them truthful, energetic, persistent, the founder of all higher humanity, etc. These men are the Aryans, or the Nordics, the master race. The damned are all other breeds, especially the Jews. The Jew, claims Hitler, is by his nature alien and cunning, a communist subversive and a capitalist exploiter. He is the personification of the devil and the symbol of all evil. The Nazi collectivism, technically, is a form of racism rather than of nationalism. But the Nazis were able to combine the two doctrines easily by the device of holding that Germany contains the purest Aryan blood. The direct source of the Nazi radical ideas was the theatricians of racism, ergo Count de Gobineau and H.S. Chamberlain, a group who rose to sudden prominence in Europe in the latter half of the 19th century. These men accepted wholeheartedly the collectivist sentiment of the period's intellectuals, and then sought to gain for that sentiment the appearance of scientific support by translating collectivism into the language of the favorite science of the time, biology. The result was a mounting torrent on the following order, from Vacher de Lepogue, a 19th century French Aryan glorifier. And here's the quote. "The blood which one has in one's veins at birth keeps all one's life. The individual is stifled by his race and is nothing. The race, the nation, is all." All right, no amount of passion for biology or for Darwin could produce such an utterance. A dose of Hegel, however, could. What the theatricians of racism did was to secularize the Hegelian approach, as Karl Popper explains eloquently. Excuse me. Marx, he observes, quote, "replaced Hegel's spirit by matter and by material and economic interests. In the same way, racialism substitutes for Hegel's spirit something material, the quasi-biological conception of blood or race. Instead of spirit, blood is the self-developing essence. Instead of spirit, blood is the sovereign of the world and displays itself on the stage of history. And instead of its spirit, the blood of a nation determines its essential destiny. The transubstantiation of Hegelianism into racialism, or of spirit into blood, does not greatly alter the main tendency of Hegelianism. It only gives it a tinge of biology and of modern evolutionism. Every central doctrine of the Nazi politics, racism included, is an expression or variant of the theory of collectivism. Such doctrines cannot rise to the ascendancy, neither among the intellectuals nor in the mind of the public, except in a culture already saturated with a mystical collectivist philosophy. In the case of Germany, this means saturated with the ideas of Hegel. No philosopher could produce a cataclysm such as Nazism single-handed. A complex series of other intellectual influences, both leading to and proceeding from Hegel, was involved in preparing the climate for the rise of the Nazis. The sum of these accessory influences determined the specific form of Hegelianism, statism, prevalent in modern Germany and picked up by the Nazis. The theoreticians of racism were merely one such influence. There was also Martin Luther, regarded by the Nazis as a major hero, who was the greatest single power in the development of German religion and, through this means, an influence on the philosophies of both Kant and Hegel. Luther is anti-reason, in parentheses, a quote, "whoever wants to be a Christian should tear the eyes out of his reason," end of quote. He was intensely pro-German and crudely anti-Semitic. And here's a quote attributed to him. "Fie on you, wherever you be, you damned Jews, who dare to clasp this earnest, glorious, consoling word of God to your maggoty, mortal, miserly belly, and are not ashamed to display your greed so openly." He formally enlists God on the side of the state. Unconditional obedience to the government's edicts, he holds, is a Christian virtue. I don't know where that's coming from. All right, it says now in a block quote, and this is, I'll tell you where the attribution comes from after. "In a like manner, we must endure the authority of the prince. If he misuse or abuses authority, we are not to entertain a grudge, seek revenge or punishment. Obedience is to be rendered for God's sake, for the ruler is God's representative. However they may tax or exact, we must obey and endure patiently." And this was taken from Walter Kaufman's book, Existentialism from Dostoevsky to Sartre, 1957, and translated from another work by E.M. LeMond. I don't know. God is such an overlay of all this stuff. On the Jews and Their Lives, Volume 405, Luther Hess Waring, The Political Theories of Martin Luther, New York Putnam's 1910, whatever. All right. There was J.G. Fichte, another Nazi hero who was an early post-Kantian idealist and an important influence on subsequent German thought, including Hegel's. Politically, Fichte, like Hegel, anticipates all the central tenets of the Nazis. He is a champion of the organic theory of the state and an authoritarian who yearns for an elite of scholar dictators to rule the ignorant masses. Because of his advocacy of state control of the economy, he is often regarded as the father of modern socialism. And here's a quote. The individual life has no real existence, since it has no value of itself, but must and should sink to nothing, while on the contrary, the race alone exists, since it alone ought to be looked upon as really living. Fichte is also one of the principal sources of the theory and delusions of German nationalism. Another quote. To have character and to be German undoubtedly mean the same. There was Karl Marx, the creator of modern communism and an arch-villain and competitor in the Nazi eyes, who nevertheless helped pave the way for Nazism by popularizing all the fundamental principles of Hegel, including his rejection of Aristotelian logic. Marx pioneered the technique, later adapted by the racists, of secularizing Hegel's ideas. He substitutes economic forces for the absolute as a determiner of history, and thus replaces Hegel's warring nations by the class struggle, and Hegel's monarchy by the dictatorship of the proletariat. It is wrong, Marx writes, to postulate an abstract, isolated human individual. My own existence is a social activity. For this reason, what I myself produce, I produce for society and with the consciousness of acting as a social being. In the classless society, he predicts, men will shed all concern for personal prerogatives, individual rights, private property. They will want only to blend with the whole. Then at last, the narrow horizon of bourgeois right can be fully left behind. And there was Friedrich Nietzsche, the prophet of the Superman and of the will to power, who was acclaimed by Hitler as one of his precursors. The extent of Nietzsche's actual influence in regard to the rise of Nazism is debatable. He is anti-statist, anti-racist, and in many respects a defender of the individual. Nevertheless, he is a fervid romanticist who revels in the post-Kantian anti-reason orgy, and there is much in his disjointed, aphoristic writings that the Nazis were able to quote with relish. A view of the universe as a realm of clashing wills, ceaseless strife, and violent conflict, a glorification of cruelty and conquest, of the magnificent blonde brute, avidly rampant for spoil and victory. The view that a few super beings, beyond good and evil, have the right to enslave the inferior masses for their own higher purposes. This is part of the Nietzschean legacy, as interpreted, with some justification, by the Nazis. And there were many other such voices in Germany, ranging from dreamy apostles of otherworldly mysticism to mindless champions of this-worldly nationalism. Many German intellectuals were both. Those best known for the former attitude include Meister Eckhart, a medieval Neoplatonist often called the father of a German mysticism, and Arthur Schopenhauer, an Orientalist doom preacher who was a major influence on men such as Nietzsche and Freud, and Frederick, Schleiermacher, a leading Romanticist theologian. Schleiermacher. Okay. Those best known for the latter attitude include Heinrich von Treitschke, an historian of the Prussian school who helped to spread Hegel's ideas. The grandeur of war lies in the utter annihilation of puny men in the great conception of the state. And that was from a good old Treitschke. Sounds a lot like Trotsky, doesn't it? Treitschke. Richard Wagner, a fiercely racist disciple of Schopenhauer, his quote, we must be brave enough to deny or intellect. That's what he said. And Arthur Muller, Vandenbroek, a literary critic and youth mentor in the Weimar Republic, who coined the term the Third Reich. His quote, we have to be strong enough to live in contradictions. All these men and movements contributed the notes, the chords, or the screeches that fused into the Horst Wessel song. And they are merely some of the obvious voices in Germany from a chorus sustained across hundreds of years and gradually rising in volume. If the brutes finally rose in the gutters and stamped a swastika across the doctrines of the centuries, if, plucking the naked essence of those doctrines from the atmosphere, they began to preach the worship of the all-powerful collectivist militarist state ruled by a master Führer in the name of the master race, and if, finding an avid following, they proceeded to drench the world in blood, one need not ask what made it possible. Lastly, in one respect, Hegel's share of the responsibility has been widely recognized. The similarity between his politics and that of Hitler is hard to escape. But Hegel's politics is not a primary. It is an expression of his fundamental philosophy, which is the culmination of a long historical development. Hegel would not have been possible but for Kant, who would not have been possible but for Plato. These three, more than any others, are the intellectual builders of Auschwitz. And that's going to end the excerpts I read from Chapter 2 of The Ominous Parallels, The End of Freedom in America by Leonard Peikoff. That came out in 1982. This might seem severe to many of you right now, and it does to me as well, but I do see it beginning. And I, without going on any longer, remember speaking with a woman who has since left Florida, who lived not that far from me, and who runs a website. And she was on the show, and we talked privately too. And she grew up in Germany. Actually, her family kind of absconded to the United States and actually went to Buffalo, New York. And everything was fine, except the father never really did it through the front door. So they threw them all back into Germany, and they did this in 1936. What a deal. So here goes the family, with this woman as the eldest child, right into the jaws of what was going to be, obviously, Nazism and World War II on the European continent. And what she said to me, and I take her at her word, was that, I mean, they lived in a country, they were somewhat near a particular city, but of not great size. And she said that for all they knew, that things were working out okay. They were all in Hitler Youth, and they had clean little uniforms. Everything was, you know, just all right. I mean, they had enough to eat and all this stuff, not realizing where this all was going, although it seemed pretty much the case, she said, that in time they would be raised more or less as, if you would, missionaries for the German way of life and go off to other countries. So understand something also here, and that is a certain amount of deprivation, which could be another depression, one that, like the one that came before World War II or the panic in 1909 that became, that came before World War I. I'm not so sure that if Americans right now who are really getting angry and really want somebody to be mad at, if the state mechanism here will not do the same thing and turn itself and others to looking at a boogeyman, whether it's Islam or whatever it should be. But I believe that Americans are being manipulated right now into feeling very badly about themselves and feeling that they've been victimized. Excuse me. And if they are not going to direct it to the state, which they really don't want to, because they still believe in this two-party system, which is a joke. But obviously, it gets to be rather obvious that, yeah, the state is probably to blame. But if the state can manufacture some events and propagandize the herd, and then we can get fueled up to go into another fight because of what's happened to us, we must go ahead and punish someone. Excuse me again. Well, anyway, that ends the reading of Chapter 2 in this Part 2 of Ominous Parallels, The End of Freedom in America. And I think it's, you know, if you can, by all means, pick up the book and read it for yourself. You decide. But I'm going to go through a couple of other chapters here to give you an idea of what I believe, and I think you might also understand, is coming to us as this patriotism that's being drummed up every time, you know, we have go through this campaign about bad old Islam and all that stuff, which began last November and still continues, bringing out the old attempted attacks and, you know, pants bombers instead of shoe bombers, and also the anthrax thing that they put to bed. We're being worked again. And eventually, these kind of like little minor agitations will give way to something big, and Americans will be primed for it, and that will turn patriotism into nationalism, as in we can't do anything wrong. We might even be there now, and that will turn into aggression and imperialism. Anyway, that's it. Thanks for listening. See you next time.